Bengala, and I'm broadcasting from the Chicago suburbs. Today, it has been 6 weeks since I last turned on my television set, and I'm missing out on all the fear tactics and fear mongering and all that nonsense that's going around. And I hope that our listeners will also kind of evaluate what they're hearing and evaluate what they're doing. It's pretty awful. Anyway, thanks for joining me today at republicbroadcasting.org, and I invite you to visit and subscribe to spingola.com, spingolaspeaks.net, screeningsandyhook.net. During the program, email your questions or comments to comment@spingola.email, and I invite you to visit our friendly chat room at spingola.chatango.com. And I'd like to welcome our guests today, James and Joanne Moriarty, and their website is libyanwarthetruth.com. And I just posted that. I will repost that in the chat room. Welcome, Jimmy and Joanne.
Thank you. We're proud to be on your show.
Hi, Diana. Nice to be with you.
Oh, well, thank you so
Deanna,
much.
Deanna, I'm sorry.
that's okay. It's a very easy mistake. Anyway, you have quite a story to tell. You were two business people, a husband and wife, that were doing business in Libya since 2007. And I think that there's a large percentage of the people that recognize what is going on in the Middle East and see these countries being attacked, the leaders being attacked, resources being stolen, for a better word for it. And it's a pretty terrible thing. And but anyway, tell us about your experience and what you tell us about.
What we'd like to do first is explain, you know, what our business is and how we ended up in Libya.
Let me say one thing, Deanna, before we get started. Libya is a North African country. It's not in the Middle East. Everybody makes that mistake because the newspapers always lump Libya into the Middle East, but it's not there. It's in the MENA region.
Oh, my gosh.
It's right across from Malta. It's at southern part of the Mediterranean. And Libya is a huge country. It's the sixth or seventh largest country in Africa. It depends on who's counting. It's the 17th largest footprint in the world. And so it's a huge country, very, very small population. In 2007, when we first went there, it was a population of 6.5 million. But as we all knew back in those days, Libya was, oh my gosh, it was a terrible place. They were full of terrorists, and they were guilty of that Lockerbie airplane and the attack on the disco in London and all this stuff. So how did we get there? Well, Joanne and I own a proprietary technology that rejuvenates oil wells and cleans up pipelines and sludge pits and chicken fat and everything else. We do a medical-grade DNA manipulation of microbes, and we literally produce millions of different enzymes. Each one is specifically designed and manufactured to do a specific thing. So in our experience, when our partner in this is a scholar from one of the first black academics to Rice University, and we had some medical doctors in Canada that approached us, and they had developed something that was absolutely going to cut them a fat calf. They were going to be able to inject these microbes under the skin and eat up all the fat, and everybody be instantly skinny. But they found out that they couldn't control it, and they were so afraid of the implications and the possible lawsuits and everything that they wanted to get rid of it completely. And John has a degree in petroleum engineer, reservoir engineer, master's degree. And so he said, are you all interested in this? And he knows that Joanne and I are entrepreneurial. So we went to Canada, met these doctors. And so we bought all their technology, lock, stock, and barrel, under the condition that their names would never be mentioned. They didn't want any association with it. The lawsuit scared them to death. So we came back and we started doing research in the laboratory, because fat is oil is greasy like that. And so we ended up developing an enzyme where we could clean tankers. And oil tankers, every time they are offloaded, you have to go in there and clean all the oil out of that tanker, because every oil has different microbes or different bacteria in it. And so if you don't clean the tanker out, you put a different kind of oil in there, the old oil might cross-contaminate the new oil. And in the long trip across the oceans, it could degrade the oil. So they always clean those out. And they always clean out using real nasty stuff. They use benzene and surfactant soap and all this stuff. And when they're through cleaning them out, now they've got this big pile of this refuse that they've got to go dispose of. And since this enzyme we were making was waterborne, we were pretty sure we could go clean out tanks and stuff like that.
Environmentally friendly.
Yeah, and it's environmentally friendly.
Right.
Doesn't have any residual problems. So we started testing. Pretty sure we were sure we had a product we could go clean the tankers. And not only that, but after we clean a tanker, we could bring all that oil along with our enzyme out and put it through an oil water separator. And now we had all that residual oil to sell as scrap oil. So we were actually making a lot of money cleaning tankers in the Houston Bay area. And so we were doing real well at that. And then some years later, a ship came in that we had cleaned a couple years earlier. And when we went in there to clean it out, it took us about 15% as much product to clean it.
Why?
Well, the only reason for that was that our enzyme had attached itself to the walls of that ship and all the pumping mechanisms and the gear works and everything. And so we began to do research on that. And sure enough, something we had no idea the enzyme was going to do, it actually puts a Teflon coating on everything. So the oil didn't stick to the surfaces of the tanker or anything. And so John decided, you know, we're doing so well above ground, we need to go test below ground, see what we can do in a well. Because if it'll actually attach itself to the well formation, then we can clear a long-term problem of oil production. Because when you drill a well, you actually are making a big cistern, if you would, in the near borehole area, where the oil flows into that. Anybody thinks oil sitting in a puddle, it's not right. It's in the crevices and rock and sand and everything. And so they always go in there and acidize a big area, dissolve the rock, and make a big cistern where that oil can flow into that pit that we made, if you would, and then you can pump it to the surface. But as oil passes through there, those fissures and those crevices and stuff, they get the debris out of the oil in there, and the oil starts to decline in production. And so every oil well starts to decline in production from the first day it's produced. And after some years, the declination is so strong that the oil well may not be economically feasible to produce. So a constant problem for an oil producer is keeping their oil wells pumping. So they're always doing oil well rejuvenation and clean out and stuff like that. Joanne's absolutely bored. She's going to sleep, so I hope I'm not putting everybody else to sleep.
No, I think this is really fascinating.
The phenomenal part about our enzyme is that when we did our first testing of oil wells, fabulously successful. But we could not get any oil company here in the United States even to allow us to test their big wells. They wanted us to test some raggedy-ass oil well that was making a half a barrel of oil and 99 barrels of water, which the probability of bringing that up to an economic event was not ever good. And in the meantime, we're going to put $40,000 or $50,000 worth of enzyme in there and break down the well and have a big expense. And even if we brought it up 400 or 500%, now wowee, we got 4 or 5 barrels of oil, you know. So what we were really looking for was wells that had dropped from 300 or 400 barrels down to maybe 50 barrels a day. That way we had an opportunity to bring it back up to an amount that would make it worth our doing it and them doing it as well. So we had terrible success. We treated wells. The oil companies wouldn't let us see the results. They would back away from the wells. They wouldn't allow us in their fields anymore. the only reason they would do that is if the success was so much that they did not want to pay us the amount that they'd agreed to. And the first two wells we treated, that guy put a chain link barbed wire fence around it. And we could still, we're all engineers, we could get out there with our cameras and calculators and figure out how much fluid was coming out of that well. And after about, 6 or 8 months of him not talking to us anymore, we finally got somebody to answer the phone. Now, these are two old, let me back that up. These were two old wells that were barely making any oil. They had made 500 or 600 barrels of oil in their early days. And the phone was answered. We said, great, we need the records on all. They said, no, we bought this company lock, stock, and barrel. And they had paid $6 million for these two wells that before we treated them were worth maybe $150,000 a piece, and very near the point where you would have to pay a lot of money to have those wells closed in and capped and made sound so that the Environmental Protection Agency wouldn't be suing the oil producer. So that was a bad first experience. So we looked around for some other wells to test. We tested a couple of wells in Kansas. These wells were separated by several miles. The oil producer was a big company called American Petroleum. He was personally worth about $175 million. We were sharp enough to get a bank guarantee for the guaranteeing our costs and everything and the increased production. And after we treated the wells, we couldn't get him to speak to us. And after some time, he said, look, that's my oil. All you're doing is getting the oil out faster. I'm not paying anything. We went to take him to court and found out that the bank guarantee he sent us was phony. He had owned the bank. So, you know, I mean, we had all kinds of problems.
Gosh.
I said, to hell with this.
Oil and gas industry is like the mafia.
Criminals. So we decided we were going to go to places that really was interested in the oil, increased oil production, and that means that we're going to deal with government-owned oil producers. And we treated at the behest of Halliburton, we treated a half dozen wells in Venezuela. We did that on a scheduled payments based on how many barrels we increased. They never paid us. We sued them, took us 3 years to get to court. We finally got about 1/6 of the payment we should have gotten.
Oh, my gosh.
So we said, hell, we're not going to deal with Halliburton anymore. And we ended up in China. We treated a well, and of course, like always, they want us to treat the worst well. So they gave us a well that for, I think it was 10 or 12 years, had never been successful. It was such a problematic well. They had tried everything in the world to fix it. And so they, when one of our engineers went over there, he was giving us the data on the well. And I was asking him about the flowability, you know, whether it was liquid when it came out of the ground, because some heavy oil is so, it's hot when it's in the ground. When you bring it up to the surface, it starts to cool down, and it ends up being like tar when you get it up above the surface. So this well had all kinds of problems. It had clay in it, which means clay expands anytime it hits water, and that'll shut a well off. It had debris. It had poor porosity, poor permeability. And so the flow rate is what, I mean, the flowability of the oil. And he misunderstood what I said. And so we went ahead and authorized it. And we sent the enzyme over there and we treated this well. And so I said, make sure you bring back some samples with you. And he brought back this oil. And of course, by the time he got back to our offices in Houston, the oil was like a rock. And I said, my gosh, I said, I ask you if it would flow above the surface. He said, no, I didn't understand that. So by then we had already sent the money in to tear this well down, all the product to treat it. And so we treated it. We didn't have much expectations. Well, up jumps the devil, and it started producing 175 barrels of oil a day.
Wow.
It never produced more than 3 or 4 days, no matter what you did to it. Well, it kept on producing and kept on producing. It wasn't going down. And all of a sudden, the Chinese government, who has 3 or 4 oil companies that they own, they were sending all their top people over there to look at this well. And it kept producing. And they had supervisors in each oil field. And that field was such a bad field. All the wells were problematic. And so he was driving around, I think it was an old 2CV, which is a French two-cylinder vehicle. It was about 40 years old. And so... The next time we saw him was about 6 months later, and what was he driving then, a Lexus or something?
Oh, my gosh.
Come way up. He became an executive of the oil company, and that well, now this was a long time ago. This was, oh, gosh, it's 15 years or so ago. Maybe 18.
How long have you been in this business?
This day, we've never retreated it.
How long have you been in this business?
Oh, over 20 years.
Okay.
And so after that well, we began to get more wells in China. We treated a couple more. They were paying. We were supplying the enzyme. They were paying all the costs of the infield equipment. Those wells were very successful. Then the Chinese government asked us if we would build a production plant in China. And we weren't very interested in that. And they said, well, they would finance the whole thing. And we got
wow.
to think, because in this interim time, we got a contract to treat every well in the Daijin field. That's their largest, it's their second largest oil production reservoir in China. And that was going to be hundreds of wells. It was a contract worth a whole lot of money. And so we did not have the production to satisfy that demand. And so we were going to have to build a plant anyhow, and they said they would finance it. And we said,
wow.
Okay, there's going to be no link to our technology. There's going to be no lien on our technology. What you'll have is the equipment less our reactors, which are proprietary. In fact, we had those built in Switzerland with some of Joanne's family. And so we started that production plant, and before we had even finished it, we got more contracts, and so Joanne and I built a second plant there from our own funds. So now we had two large-scale enzyme production plants. We could produce a different enzyme every day at each plant. We closed them down one day a week to clean everything up. And so we were going gangbusters, and our contracts in China were that we would charge them slightly more than our costs, and then we would receive 30% of the increased production for a negotiated period of time. And most of the time we tried to get 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody needs to appreciate the fact that all the Halliburton, well rejuvenation, and Schlumberger, all the big companies, their rejuvenation processes might last 60 days, might last 90 days. And the costs are equivalent to about 30 days worth of the increased production. So, Halliburton treated all oil well rejuvenation like a rent check. They were going to go back to that well again.
Right.
Go back to that well again, and our treatments last approximately 3 years or so. So, we really have no peers in that. Well, we're producing. We're rejuvenating oil wells in China. We're doing two to three a week. We're having great success. We had a lot of really interesting tests. Like when we first went into China, Joanne and I don't do business in the country. We always hire local people. We set them up as their
sure.
as the contractors, and they do all the negotiation. They take care of all the more detailed backsheesh or whatever. We don't want to see any of that. All we want is a sample of the target, whether it's a well, pipeline, whatever. And then we go into our laboratory, and we do our magic in the laboratory, and we produce an enzyme that best addresses that issue. And in China, we set up 13 agents. The first year in China, each one of those became $1 million.
Wow.
So they were having success. We were having success. And so after just a few years, the bonus payments were not coming out as they should have been.
Wow. All right. We're going to make a quick 3-minute break. This is fascinating. This is so fascinating. We'll be right back.
As a listener of RBN, you're surely concerned about being informed and being ready for whatever may come. Please consider the following questionnaire as a soul-jarring wake-up call. If you answer no to more than two of these following questions, you probably aren't going to make it through any major disruption in our country. The questions were compiled by people that have been there. Are you really ready? Do you own your own firearm for the primary defense and protection of you and your loved ones? Have you ever been professionally trained to stand against life-threatening behavior? Have you ever practiced enough to fire 500 rounds during a 2 to 4 day time frame, day and night? Can you load, unload, fire, and clear a jam in total darkness? Have all the adults in your household been professionally trained? Are you, life and death, comfortable with your abilities with pistol, revolver, shotgun, and rifle? Are you aware that everything that you do to prepare for an emergency is a waste of time, money, and energy? If you haven't honed your abilities to their highest level to protect and keep what you have, do you have the repair parts that will most likely be needed for each of your firearm, and do you have the ability to install those parts? Could you completely clean every firearm you own? Are you aware that your body won't go where your mind hasn't been? In other words, without proper training, followed by regular practice, you probably will not win a gunfight. Well, how did you measure up? Take the once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to start correcting your deficiencies by receiving your Commander Lifetime Membership with Front Sight Firearms Training Facility. A one-time donation to RBN for $500 will give you a Commander Lifetime Membership at Front Sight as a tremendously huge thank-you bonus. See details on RBN's webpage to make it happen. The clock is ticking. You had better be ready before it happens.
Tired of being lied to by mass media? It's growing more and more apparent today that news is received less and less through standard media outlets, even with a growing audience every day. RBN is beginning to direct more efforts into social media. Social media and the use of the internet is fast becoming the primary source of people for news, regardless of demographic. RBN has set out to provide some of the best news on the internet through republicbroadcasting.org and also has begun to use the tools to our advantage by way of social media. Republic Broadcasting is now operating a Facebook page to function as yet another avenue to have our collective voice reach new audiences across not only America, but across the globe as well. The Facebook page features not only news, but also an RBN player to listen to our broadcast. Get involved by visiting facebook.com/republicbroadcasting and liking our page and share it with your friends and family, because you can handle the truth.
Starts with you and me. It starts with you and me. We all can be heroes if we take the lead to change the bad to good, to live in harmony.
All righty, we are back. We are back with our guests for today, and I find this information really, really fascinating. James and Joanne Moriarty, and their website is LibyanWarTheTruth.com, and you can subscribe for on their email list and get their latest articles. I was thinking about Halliburton during the commercial because Halliburton does not have a really great name. And I think that Halliburton was, and is posted in the chat room, that Halliburton kind of took over Russia's oil industry, if my sources are correct. I wrote an article about this some time back. But go ahead.
Okay, well, the payments from China wasn't coming out properly, and we knew they were doing a whole lot more business. Now, when you're receiving a lot of money from a foreign government, it may look like a whole lot of money. You know, there may have been a couple of hundred million in net paid to the foreign company, you know, that we were operating for several years. That looks like a lot of money, but what was owed was another zero behind that.
Oh.
And so we reduced the amount, the supply for them. Even though we had two plants operating at full capacity, we cut the capacity back. We said, you know, we're having trouble maintaining this capacity without your payment, so you're going to have to pay us. They didn't pay.
They're
agreed payments. And so we're on the bonus side, not on the front end side. They paid that like a clock. And so they slow paid and no paid on the bonuses or very little payment on the bonuses. And we ended up cutting back to 10% of our capacity. Now, we paid all of our scientists and engineers and techs, we paid them full price with all their bonuses as if we were at full capacity because it wasn't their fault.
Right.
And for that reason, those guys remained very, very loyal to us. And so in the end, we took China to court. When we finally got it to court, it only took about a year to get them to court. And the court in China would not even hear the case because they said their oil and gas production was of a national security importance, and therefore the case wouldn't be heard. So Joy and I had a decision to make. We had to go find another market. We looked all over the world, and we looked at Libya, but Libya was, you know, it wasn't any place we were really too interested in because of all the history we had heard. And we just could not find another.
All the misinformation that was put out.
But we didn't know it was misinformation.
Right, but that's what we were listening to.
And so Libya had been producing 3.8 million barrels of oil a day. They'd been sanctioned, and their oil production was down to less than a million barrels a day. They were all big wells. They had every criteria. If we were picking the best possible candidate for us to go into, Libya was top on the list. So in 2006, Condoleezza Rice signed a treaty with Gaddafi in Libya. The sanctions were removed. And through a connection Joanne had with a royal family member in England who had known Gaddafi, he had a publishing company, and he had written reports about all the history on Gaddafi wasn't as stated. And so he was able to help us get visas into Libya. And we actually we arrived in Libya January 1st, 2007. We were the first non-government entity into Libya, period. And it was real funny. Our visa was our name on a piece of paper. We didn't have a piece of paper, and we weren't sure if we were going to get there, when we got there, what was going
to
happen.
It was real sent strange to us an old fax machine, a big, long piece of paper with a lot of Arabic on it. Libya had not had any visas before that because they were closed, you know, for 30-some years.
Wow.
And so they had to start a visa.
So we took that to British Airways, and they said, this is it. But, you know, if you get there
and you're stuck,
you know, you're going to have to use your return ticket to come back. And we said, okay, you know. So we flew into Libya. We were received at the airport. We were taken. They had a long line to get everybody's visas checked. There was a guy that we never met. Took us around the long line. We were through clearance. And incidentally, in 2007, after you arrived in Libya, you had to go through screening of your luggage and everything three times. Hell of a lot more security than I've seen any place in the world. And that was going into Libya. So that was something we expected. You know, oh, incidentally, I bought a bushel basket of headscarves for Joanne so she could cover up. And she won't even wear, she's a cowgirl at heart. She won't even wear a cowboy hat. So we got there, and I asked the guy that met us, I said, does Joanne need to wear a scarf? He said, no, that's ridiculous. And so we had brought with us four guards. These guys were as big as Dallas Cowboy linebackers. We had four of them. They were security guys. And our intent was to have some kind of protection with us. After we'd been in Tripoli for 2 days, I sent them home. We were safer walking the streets of Tripoli in 2007 than we were any place in Houston.
Wow. And
everybody that saw us got a big grin on their face. Americans, oh, me and me, Hollywood, you know, great.
Oh, that's
everybody
amazing.
We met had a smile. And it was so amazing because not what we expected at all.
We do have to break for just a real quick commercial, and we'll pick this up on the other side. Wow. Great. You're right there.
You are tuned in to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Visit our website by going to republicbroadcasting.org.
Many people tell us about their experience with Extendivite. Just listen to what Glenn has to say.
Prior to taking it, I had diabetic neuropathy. The Extendivite reduced that significantly. Acid reflux was reduced. I had athlete's foot, very severe. Trimmed that down to about 75% dandruff. Almost completely gone. I had a I would skip a beat, very uncomfortable. And when walking from downstairs going to sleep, by the time I got to the bedroom, which is just one flight of stairs, my heart was pounding, coming out of my chest. My vision was blurry. This completely solved that problem. Great product. Thanks.
Tell us your story. Get Extendivite today. Call 1-877-928-8822 or visit heartdrop.com.
Extend your life with Extendivite.
Talk Right, the conservative app offered by TalkStream Live that caters exclusively to the conservative talk radio community. Here you'll see only talk shows and podcasts from the conservative right, all the big broadcast names and online digital shows in one place. Talk Right makes it easy to find all your favorite conservative talkers with all the upscale features you come to expect from TalkStream Live. Keep up with the fast-paced political world. Download Talk Right today from Google Play or the App Store.
The Republic Broadcasting Network, late night premiere show of Red Pill Hardcore, is hosted by activists that want to hear from you, the listeners, so that you can get involved in the activism. Please call in at 800-313-9443 at 10 p.m. to enter the discussion. To book yourself as a guest, call our studio at 202-657-5715 or contact RBN staff. Remember, keep it real and take the Red Pill.
Corporate media dominates the American opinion. Finding independent voices that counter this avalanche is becoming increasingly difficult. With the endless corruption running rampant throughout our government, independent voices are needed more than ever to battle the offensive against our freedoms and liberties. As a listener of RBN, no one understands this concept better than you. Now it's up to you to do your part. The time has come for you to take action and begin broadcasting the truth to hundreds or thousands of people every month. Sound impossible? Quite the contrary. With pointed slogans from LibertyStickers.com, you can reach countless sleeping Americans unaware that they live in a real-life wonderland. LibertyStickers.com has a huge inventory of political bumper stickers and messages that reflect the truth about our government, our politicians, and the future of America. With so many in stock, there's one perfect for you. Visit us today at LibertyStickers.com. Again, that's LibertyStickers.com. Do your part. Your voice is important. Let it be heard.
Okay. Okay, back with our guests today, James and Joanne Moriarty. And
okay, well, our story is did our you have song, so you know.
Ken, did you have something to play?
Me?
Ken.
No? Oh.
Okay. Yeah, just go ahead. Okay. I just wanted to add a little bit of flavor to what you're saying. Okay. Thank you so much. It's terrific.
From the halls of Montezuma to the shores of Tripoli.
Yeah, yeah.
The Marines were fighting in Tripoli, you know, that one of the first places that we had a navy that era ships that went to fight, they were fighting the Ottomans and the Berber pirates there. And they used to put the Berber pirates and they had these big swords, scimitars. Yeah. So it was kind of curved swords, and they would slice the heads off of their enemies.
Yikes.
So that there was an invention made with these thick leather collars that would protect the throats of the Marines, and that's how they became the Leathernecks.
Wow.
So if you look at the Marine uniform, it's got a stiff, straight, short collar.
The dress uniform, yeah. Has a stand-up collar.
Hmm.
Just a little history. But getting back to our story, so we were in Libya and absolutely astounded at how the people liked us, how nice the people were. And we'd gone in there to our plan was 5 days because we had an appointment with the Minister of Petroleum in Egypt about 7 days after we landed in Libya. And one of the Kuwaiti royal family members was going to meet us in Egypt to see about possibly doing some oil rejuvenation there. And the Libyans, after about the third day, they asked us if we would mind meeting with some
ministers.
Of their ministers and everything.
After work.
And we said, sure. And so we always demonstrate our product first, and then we had meetings that would start at like 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 at night and go until the wee hours of the morning. And every night it was a different minister, and they were so open to learn how business was done in the West, because they had had no communication in the West in 40 years. And each one was real interested in, and, you know, we told them, well, you know, this is great, but we're going to be leaving tomorrow. Oh, no, 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 you can't leave. You can't leave yet. We have a lot more
questions.
And I said, well, you know, we came here to try to see if we could do our business. No, we want to buy your product. And they actually signed a contract with us to rejuvenate 2,500 of their monster wells. That contract was worth about $600 million to $1 billion of our product.
Holy cow.
I don't think he was in business any place. That was a grand slam home run in the World Series. Nobody gets that kind of contract. And the reason that they were comfortable in doing that contract, first of all, we can demonstrate that our product works. But second of all, they don't really trust men that much, but they trust women. So Joy and I are the entire marketing team, and we'd go and do our presentation, and then I would speak. Of course, I'm her dancing bear. And then when I was through speaking, they would look at Joanne and they'd say, "Sister, what did he say?"
So, well, you have to understand that Jimmy has a Texas accent.
No, really?
And his words roll together real smooth. You know, they just all roll together. And when you're trying to translate in your head from Arabic to English,
right,
the words don't make any sense half the time. And I'm from Oregon. I'm an Oregonian. So
right.
I don't have that. And so they just look at me and they say, "My sister," they'd all turn their heads to me and say, "What did he say?"
Right.
So I'd have to repeat what he said. And they really like that in Libya. Libyans feel like men can cheat you and trick you, but women wouldn't do that. That's their cultural difference.
But also, that was a very telling thing, because women in Libya, in fact, tell them about what women
in
Libya.
Well, you know, we thought we were going into a country like Saudi Arabia, where women were forced to wear burqas and cover their faces, and we didn't
right.
know.
That's why you bought all those scarves.
Yeah, well, what happened in Libya in the 70s, when they had their al-Fatah revolution in 1969 and threw out the old despot king who was just working with England, and England actually put him in there, as old Libya never had really a king. There was some guy who was a leader in the east at one time. But he took all the oil money. He took his graft, but nothing went to the Libyans. It was the poorest, most least country in Africa. The average salary was 60 dinar a year. And you had the Italians who were in there, who had been in there for a long time, since long before World War One even. They were raping the country in the sense that they had these giant olive orchards and huge mansions and stuff. And the Libyans were just their slaves. They never were allowed. They didn't own any land or anything. So
the Libyans hadn't owned their land for thousands and thousands
of years.
Yeah,
there's been a whole bunch of different countries that have invaded Libya, over the Ottomans, the you know, the Romans, all of them. Well, when they had their revolution in 1969, 11 tribes came together and threw out the old king, and it was a bloodless coup. He just ran off because he knew he was an old despot.
He was a pedophile. He was a criminal. And like Joanne said, Libya had the lowest pay scale and lowest standard of living in all of Africa.
Well, when they put Gaddafi in charge, the tribes put him in charge because he was very well educated. He spoke a number of languages. He was very charismatic, and he understood a lot of how the Western business worked and how the banks worked. And so he took over the country, and he immediately formed his Jamahiriya, which was this, they call it the Socialist Republic of Libya, but it really wasn't, because what he did was share. He nationalized the oil, took it out of the hands of you know, Shell and whoever else was there, and he took the money for the country, and 50% of that went to the people, 49% of it was used to run the government.
That's how it should be.
Yeah, and that's, the Libyans, there's no tax in Libya.
Never was.
There never was any tax. And so what you had was a country being developed and being shared. All the Libyans were given the land that they had been slaves on when Gaddafi took over. He immediately gave them the land throughout the Italians. throughout the Turkish people, throughout all the people who were raping that country. And Libya began to become a country where the people were proud, where they came together. They're still a big tribal country. Their culture is tribal and ancient tribes. But in that time, in the 70s, Gaddafi looked at women wearing whatever they were wearing and not having any jobs or anything, and he emancipated women in the 70s. And he didn't even like headscarves. He said, this is not part of our Quran. We don't require women to wear anything special. He also, women were emancipated in the fact that they were doctors, lawyers, entrepreneurs, whatever.
They drove their own cars.
They drove their own cars. They were in the military. They were actually probably more emancipated than we are here. They were highly respected, and I never heard anybody raise their voice to a woman in Libya. If you raised your voice, you were in trouble. There was no raping of women. There was no beating of women. There was no, that would have been so bad that that person would have either been killed or thrown out of the country. Now, so women had a great, they were allowed to divorce. And in a divorce situation, the woman got the house and the children, and the man had to pay her money that it cost for her to live. And if he didn't pay it, his family had to pay it. And his family didn't pay it, his tribe had to pay it.
So there was absolute responsibility. You know, you took responsibility for what you did. It was a really interesting culture, and really the more we're there, more we're learning about it. And so when they wanted us to stay over, we knew that Libya only took money. They didn't take credit cards. They didn't have debit cards. They didn't do anything. So we had brought a pretty substantial amount of money, but Libya being an oil-producing country, the hotels and everything were very expensive. We were paying $680 a night for the hotel, the first hotel we stayed at. And so money was running out pretty quick, and so I needed to get some more money in there. We agreed to stay over.
No international banks.
Yeah, no international banks at all. And the international bank in Libya was Wells Fargo.
No.
Pardon me.
Western Union.
I fell in love with Libya at that time because I had been a banker most of my adult life, and I was so amazed the country could have that much potential, that many natural resources, and have developed like it was without the negative influence of the banksters, the Khazarian mafias, the Rothschild, Rockefeller, Medici bunch were not in Libya.
Libya had developed, Deanna, from being the least developed country in Africa when the Al-Fatah Revolution in 1969 took place, to the most developed country in 40 years. Gaddafi did that in 40 years.
Wow.
See, that's what you can do if you work with the people and share the wealth with the people.
So
the wealth of the country, not taxes.
So we were asked to stay over. They gave us this huge contract. Well, of course we did. So we got money, had one of our banks, had to absolutely go take an agent to Western Union to get money over to us. So we were in a position to stay there. We stayed another 5 or 6 days. And, of course, we now had this big obligation to figure out how to do business in Libya, because we really went in there to have a look at it, not to do business.
Right.
So we then had to go back and start to research how to do business in Libya. And it took us over a year to determine, because it's such a closed country. They only had about 350,000 foreigners a year in Libya, and all those were in the oil and gas production. Very, very little tourism. They had some desert trips and stuff like that, but not much, you know, a few thousand a year.
It's because they didn't have a lot of hotels. They didn't have, you know, they had hotels in Tripoli and one hotel in Benghazi, but very few towns had places to put people up who were traveling.
Plus, sure, they were foreigners for good reason, you know. So we began to research how to do business in Libya, and we went back several times. They would like to have had us be there all the time, and we went back to Libya many, many times. From 2007 till 2011, we'd been into Libya 17 times, never less than 30 days, many, many times, 3 months or longer at a time. We traveled all over Libya. And every time we went back to Libya, almost every time we got another contract. And by first part of 2011, we actually had over $5 billion worth of business booked in Libya. And it took us that long to find the equitable partner, and we actually signed contracts. Joanne was still suffering from a really debilitating disease.
I had giardia.
Yeah, giardia. And she's 1 in 100,000 it normally kills. But I was in Libya. I arrived there again January 1st, 2011. I signed joint venture agreements with one of the Social Security funds. And incidentally, the Social Security funds, Libya had six of them. They were regional, and they were all, each one had a different sector of the people that were their beneficiaries. The largest one was the Tripoli Social Security Fund, and it was a $33 billion fund. The one we signed our joint venture agreements with was the John Zuer Social Security Fund, which actually benefited all the retirees from the oil and gas industry. And that was really important to us because all those retirees had input into every oil and gas producer, the national oil company, et cetera. And we took the time and spent the money to make our companies legitimate Libyan companies. To do that, you had to have 11 original documents. Each document had to have the local notary, like we would have the Secretary of State in Texas notarize it. Then that notary had to go to Washington, D.C., and it was notarized by the U.S. Secretary of State. Then that document went to an official accepted Libyan translator, and that translator made two separate copies. And then those were delivered to the Libyan consulate in Washington, D.C., and they added their stamp for a fee. And each document in this entire had to be 11 originals of each one. And each set of documents was probably 3 or 4 inches thick.
They were in binders.
Joanne and I did all the legwork. We had $650,000 just in the documentation to present to Libya so we could be legalized in Libya.
But nobody else does that. We were
Nobody's ever done that.
We were registered as a Libyan company.
So we could receive payments directly from the government. And this was real interesting. Only place I've ever seen this. Before the government of Libya could sign a contract, they had to have all the money in the bank
to pay for that contract.
So if you signed a contract in Libya, you were going to be paid unless you'd signed your a joint venture with the Khazarian mafia that was in Misrata. They moved into Libya these are the fake Jews. These were about 150 years earlier.
They were from Turkey.
They settled in Misrata, and they were the mafia. They were the bad guys. They were the ones that because the Libyans are the most non-confrontational people we've ever met. But the Misrata mafia, they were strong-arming everybody. They were threatening everybody.
They had 50% of all contracts.
40% of all contracts in Libya were issued to them without bid or tender. And then they would get those contracts, and they would turn around and subcontract with foreign developers and everything. And then, of course, being criminals, they would short pay them. They would sign change orders with the government. They'd get additional payments. They wouldn't pay the contractors. And so there were actually 150 major contracts, projects in Libya that were abandoned by the foreign companies for no payment by the mafia.
The Libyans knew about the mafia. They told Jimmy, they said, that's where Alibaba lives.
Yeah, there's a real nice building on the outside of Tripoli, you know, about 10 miles, nice 10-story building, you know. And I said, what's that building? Oh, you know, that's Alibaba. And I said, Alibaba? You know, Alibaba, Alibaba. And I said, Alibaba, you know, Alibaba and the thieves.
Oh, right, right.
That was their, you know, story.
So they knew about it.
We
were cautious about doing that, but Misrata was the only port city in Libya, and it was, for a container port, it was a smaller container port. They would only handle 100,000 ton containers, which is small. 120,000 is about the smallest today, but they can only handle one a day. So all ingress and egress of goods and services to and from Libya went through Misrata, controlled by the bad guys.
And they wouldn't allow any other ports to be built because the Chinese approached us and wanted to build ports in Libya and gave a great price. And so we went right to the top, to the people who were in charge of that, and they were shut down before it ever got through.
So, you know, here we are. We're a legitimate company. We've got all these contracts in hand, and we're looking for a for an equitable partner in Libya. We just get that finished. And that was first part of 2011. And really, from the first day I was back there in 2011, the Libyans were real concerned because they said there are these real hard people coming in from all over. Libya had no, there was no visa required from any African country or any Arab country into Libya. So the open ingress and egress for that. And they said there are people coming into Libya, real hard men, not normal. And they said they're coming in here and they try to go to work for the military. And he said they can fix any piece of military hardware. The Libyans had not been able to get any repair parts for any of their aircraft or any all their tanks and their, all their equipment. They couldn't get any parts in. And we constantly got asked to help them secure parts, and we never were successful in finding any supplier.
Even though they'd been signed off on this so-called agreement, yeah, this treaty that was signed with Condoleezza Rice, and then in 2009, John McCain went in there too. And it, in that treaty, tell them what was required of the first treaty.
The first treaty, Libya had to get rid of 50% of its military.
Oh, wow.
They had to get rid of all of their offensive weapons, and they had to eliminate their nuclear enrichment program, which they agreed to. And Chris Stevens, his first trip into Libya was part of the UN inspection. Inspection team where they dismantled the nuclear enrichment of Libya. Now, the side note on that, we met the professor of nuclear physics in Libya, who was the head of their the equivalent Atomic Energy Commission. His name was Dr. Nori Dorogi. He looks kind of like Einstein or Jonathan Winters when he's
no, not Jonathan Winters. I mean, he looks like the guy that played the Pink Panther.
Yeah. Anyway. And so he told us that the nuclear enrichment program was set up completely by the CIA, that he was flown from Tripoli in a military aircraft, large C-130, from Tripoli to Florida. They would pick up the yellow cake, which is the raw material that you use to enrich the uranium, concentrate it, and then he was flown back into Tripoli. And the centrifuge machines and everything, those were built with designs from Russia and from the United States. And they were continually supplied, and the technology was delivered by the CIA.
This was instigated by the CIA. It was not a Gaddafi instigation. It was a CIA instigation. Of course, they did blame it on Gaddafi.
So this is why, Libya was such a threat, because here's this big terrorist company. And the truth is, they were not involved in terrorism at all. In fact, until these guys started coming in 2011, if you had a beard and a mustache, you were really not accepted in the Libyan society. You would not be moved up in the company, that you work for. And, that was the beard and the mustache was a symbol of really a Muslim brotherhood. And Libyans didn't like that.
Well, Gaddafi was anti-radical Islam. And he gave many speeches, even one. He's one of the first people that spoke out about Al-Qaeda years and years ago. And he said, this is a big problem. We can't have this. And there were no radical Islamists, or if there were radical Islamists, they were either in exile or in prison in Libya.
Yeah.
So they didn't have that problem. That all was brought in by the CIA, by Hillary Clinton, by NATO, whoever was working in 2011 to blow up the country. They brought in, 250,000 of these ISIS-type terrorist mercenaries, which they did move a lot to Syria, too. After that, but that's how the country was taken over, by all these illegal mercenaries that came in there, because there was no revolution. The people were not against their government at all.
And you're going to ask, why was Libya targeted? Well, I'll tell you exactly why. This is the real reason. Gaddafi, one of the conditions of the treaty of 2006 was he stepped down from power, which he did immediately, and they had an election.
And they had to take all the money.
The election, a guy named Baghdadi was elected as the president of Libya. Also, Libya had to take all of its money and invest it in the Federal Reserve, European Bank, and Bank of Japan. So $500 billion.
Oh, my gosh, I'm sick.
Put into the hands of the Khazarian mafia. Libya had 179 tons of gold, 2,000 tons of silver, million tons of all the heavy earths, rare earths, etc.
All gone, stolen.
And so Gaddafi knew the evil of the bad bankers, and so he had started the African Bank. This is after he resigned. And
he was the head of African Union.
He was first president of the African Union. And he really wanted to model the African Union after Abraham Lincoln's design for the United States. And the African Union was established. Its head offices were in the Comore Islands, and it was going to be based on a gold-backed dinar currency for all of Africa with the resources of Africa behind it. Every Arab country had signed up as members. Half of Africa had signed up as members. But the Khazarian mafia, the Federal Reserve, and all these toilet paper bankers could not have that. So Libya was blown up in order to kill the African, the gold-backed dinar of Africa. That was the primary reason. And that's you can find that out in documents.
It's in Hillary Clinton's emails that they've released.
So, you know,
really?
That was the reason Libya was blown up.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, my gosh. We probably all know this, but hearing all of the details, the details is just mind-boggling. We know that, well, at least I suspected that Gaddafi was killed, murdered, and that the United States did it. But to hear the exact details and what was transferred from Libya is just amazing.
They used Libyan money to destroy Libya.
Oh,
that money was partitioned out amongst all the banksters, all the radical, the ISIS and Al-Qaeda, Muslim Brotherhood.
Yeah, yeah.
And all that was done with complete collusion of the Federal Reserve. The first week of this phony revolution where they moved all these mercenaries into Libya, and there was no revolution. This was absolutely a phony flag operation from day one. Mm-hmm. The three supposedly people were killed by Gaddafi were actually killed by mercenaries from Qatar.
Wow. Okay, we will be right back. It's the top of the hour. We'll be right back.
Republic Broadcasting Network, we have been building our online store. Well, we have been focusing on bringing you the best talk show host in the country. Here at Republic Broadcasting Network, we also want our listeners to have products they can use every day and in times of emergency. We have added new products each week to our store. Your support of this network, plus products at the best prices, is a win-win situation. Check out our new store. Go to our website, republicbroadcasting.org, and click on the online store located at the top of our website. Together, we can continue to grow RBN and help our listeners prepare for the future. Go to republicbroadcasting.org and click on our online store or call us.
800-724-2719, extension 3. 800-724-2719, extension 3.
You're listening to Republic Broadcasting Network. Because you can handle the truth.